But then I got a call from the producer. Sorry, your name didn't make the list for boot camp. So that rocked my world.
Did they say why?
No, they didn't say why. No, you know what? I think the excuse actually was Thomas's face.
Yeah.
When he looks up, and I felt it for him. I was like, surely, right? He could.
Right.
He's right there.
Right.
You know. And then,
but you are the niche ultimately.
Right.
When an artist has that, mm-hmm. in my opinion, that's when we're looking at decades ahead.
Right.
Bruce Lawn.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is all over the country right now, touring arenas. That's why she's here with us. She has over 1.5 million monthly listeners on Spotify. She's signed to one of the biggest Christian labels out there. Without any further ado, we have Tarian in the house.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Man, thanks for having me here, man. It's really cool being here.
Okay, so I did a deep dive on your music.
Okay.
And I, really liked it.
Thank you.
I think the writing is phenomenal. Mm. The packaging, your aesthetic, just across the board. I'm like, this is so dope where I almost don't know if the Christian audience is fully getting it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
even though you have the accolades and the arenas and the 1.5 million monthly listeners, which is a huge feat in and of itself. So have you experienced any tension in terms of the Christian market receiving it? Because it's not like cookie cutter.
Right.
But it's also Christian, overtly Christian. But in my opinion, the writing and the production and the quality is at an elite mainstream and beyond level, right?
Yeah.
So is there, like, are you navigating any of this tension within the Christian music industry of just like, we don't really know what to do with this girl?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anyone that is doing what I'm trying to do will have that tension. Because of course, like with every industry, there are markets for it, you know? And so you have CCM, which is a market, you have gospel, which is a market. And then I think CHH is struggling even to figure out what their market is, you know? So I feel that tension. And I think for me, I have to be very intentional when I'm writing, and searching for singles, being sure that I'm still remaining true to who I am. So I take forever to like figure out what my single is going to be, because I have to be sure that with this market that we're going to push it to, I'm represented well and I'm represented authentically with that. It is a struggle sometimes trying to figure that out, but I have peace of mind at the end of the day, because I'm like, I know that that's authentically who I am.
You said writing, is there a team that you create with?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who are some of the folks on the team? Because that to me, like, instantly, obviously your voice is incredible.
Thank you.
The aesthetic is great. But the part that stood out to me as a creative is the writing. Like, your pen is insane. So how are you guys writing these songs? How many people are involved? What is it? Do you start with a humming voice note?
Yeah.
And then is that even, like, tell me your process a little bit.
I mean, there are several different ways. For me, it can start with a humming voice note, voice memos. Sometimes it's walking into the studio and then the producer has a track and we start there and then end up somewhere else, which happens a lot with me in the studio. I have about 3 to 4 people that I love to write with. And I have a handful of producers that I love to work with. Gabe Patillo, his mom is the president of GMA. He's one of my favorite people to write with. Toby Mack is also someone I love writing with. Kyle Williams, he's like my favorite producer and also writer. I think he understands my sound so well. And he knows that I love real instruments as well. So he'll always bring out the trumpets and the keys and the guitars. And then recently, Aaron Cole introduced me to Joel Sedian. And that was, man, I mean, he was a godsend, you know, as we're writing the album. So I've found people that I love writing and working with.
Shout out to the people behind the scenes, because they seldom get the props, because it really does take a labor of love collectively and community to I think, get stuff to the level that your stuff is at.
Yeah.
And shout out to Aaron Cole for connecting you.
That's
and
the bro, man.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So how would you describe what you do? That's my first question. Because I think you mentioned CCM, gospel, and CHH.
Yeah.
And I hear all of it.
Yeah.
But how would you define it? Because go ahead.
Yeah, man. So it's funny. Toby always calls his music a musical pot of gumbo. And I feel that deeply. I've loved a lot of different sounds over the years because I grew up listening to gospel music and R&B and then pop music. And I was like, I mean, people are saying you kind of have to choose one. And I just refuse to do that. I'm like, I'm not going to choose one. Whatever comes out naturally in the studio, that's what I'm going to write. And we'll figure out the rest later. Mm-hmm. And so thankfully, I have an A&R that's like, just go write a really good song. And then we can figure it out later. And so that's what I do.
And then after you write a good song, a handful of good songs, does the team then come in, help you in terms of, hey, we can take this one to Christian radio and this could do well there.
Yep.
This is the one we may really try and work organically on TikTok and try to get it to pop off on Instagram Reels. That's kind of the process.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially for the CCM singles. If we hear one has potential to go there, that's when we'll bring in Toby for writing on that.
Okay.
And we're like, okay, you know how to do this, you know, so help us like sculpt this song the way that it needs to be. And so he has a huge hand in production even on those things. And so it's been really, really cool getting to like learn and watch his process and then bring all that over to my thing.
How developed is the song by the time it gets to Toby? Is it, do you have lyrics and vocals on it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually there are lyrics, vocals, and then we just go back and fine tune just all the things, you know, and figure out, is this the right perspective? Is this a me song, or is this a speaking to the audience song, you know, or is it vertical, you know? So we're like overthinking intentionally the whole thing.
Do you have a preference out of those three, right? Because mm-hmm. you can write songs that are expressions of what you're going through, you can write songs that are speaking to an audience, empowering mm-hmm. songs, and then there's obviously the overt vertical worship songs,
right? I think for me, I'm always like, we have to have space for the vertical worship songs there, but naturally it's always like coming from like a testimonial standpoint, but we did add one song that is speaking to the audience for this record because we don't have that. so yeah, but most of the time I think it is coming from like personal walk.
I love that. I think something I've discovered recently, we've been thinking a lot about in terms of what we do here, because it's similar, right? Yeah. Are you a podcaster? Are you a reactor? I'm in the process of writing a book, right? What are you? What do you do? And one of the things we've been discovering, and this terminology is starting to come out more with guys like Dan Coe, is that you are the niche, right? Mm. You don't need a niche. We don't need to fit you into anything because the world has became smaller.
Yep.
TikTok, Instagram Reels, YouTube has made everything smaller. Yeah. Spotify has its own algorithm that they want to find people to listen to you.
Yep.
And yes, Christian radio still has its position and it's still super duper important, but you are the niche ultimately.
Right.
And I think when an artist has that, in my opinion, that's when we're looking at decades ahead.
Right.
Instead of like, can we get this to go now on Christian radio?
Yep.
Right.
100%.
Where are you 10 years from now, 20 years from now? Right. Yep. Because you are the niche you're cultivating, as you said, Toby calls it gumbo.
Yep.
I think that is going to transcend any current packaging.
Yes.
Right? Packaging. Absolutely. Packaging on our end is what we were just talking about. How do we package this video in a way that is interesting to people while sliding in the medicine into the candy?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's like the packaging can evolve and can shift. But if the guts of something is there and it's unique and it's refreshing, I think that positions you to do
100%.
Way bigger than just a cookie cutter version.
I agree. The cool thing about the label that I'm signed to, Goatee, is they're like, you guys have to be songwriters. You have to be. And so my first year and a half was like artist development, which is something that I don't believe most labels do anymore.
Yeah,
yeah. And so that space to just go and write and fail at it and then succeed at it and then fail at it again, I think helped me figure out how to write a song, because that's what keeps you around a very long time. When I look at Toby and Kirk Franklin, I'm like, oh, they're still writing, like, and they still love it, you know? And so that's my encouragement to any artist, keep writing the songs you have to write. It's so important.
You said the songs can be very calculated and intentional. How much of it would you say is a science and how much of it is an art? Because if I think of a Kirk or a Toby, they probably have their systems down.
Right.
I bet there's some secret book somewhere with all the cheat codes and the rules and however they do things, right? But and when you're working with a Toby, how much of that is there where it's like, no, we have these kind of parameters, right? And then you you kind of work within those confines versus mm-hmm. like how much of it is just art and vibes and just free flowing yeah. creativity.
If there are parameters, it's only going to be for like two songs.
Okay.
Because if you need an album, you need at least two singles. So the rest of the album, you're just free. Mm. Mm. But those singles even start free. Mm-hmm. And so because of how I write and how I like to, you know, exist as an artist, it starts with the art. And then we hear potential and what could be a single. Mm-hmm. And that's when we bring in the parameters. But even if those parameters don't feel authentic to me, we're like, then we get rid of that. Mm. And we just keep at it. Even if it takes a long time, we just keep working at it until we nail it, you know?
That's interesting. So you're driving the whole process, yeah. essentially. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a single, there are certain confines yep. you have to operate in.
Yep.
But not if they're impeding on your ultimate creativity.
100%.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that now, as we're seeing the explosion of a Maverick City, mm-hmm. which is similar,
yep.
they don't quite fully fit in the gospel world, mm-hmm. they don't quite fully fit in the CCM yeah. world, do you think that that's also creating a palette and an expectation where the consumer is a bit more open and curious and interested, and they're not just, yeah, you know, soccer moms who listen to CCM and that's it. That's the target audience. No, there's yeah. a whole other world out here,
right?
Because there's Maverick City Music. I don't know if you're familiar with my buddy Ryan Horton and the stuff he's doing. Mm. He's doing these like out public worship things in the streets.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Super
yeah.
dope, yeah. right? And so I feel like there's an audience being cultivated and has been cultivated that I think would make it easier for an artist such as yourself that doesn't really fit.
Yeah. I mean, that I think social media is helping big time with that right now. And what Maverick did, I think it reflects the culture in the time that we are in right now, where people just want freedom and something organic. Mm-hmm. And Maverick's thing feels organic, you know. It doesn't fit within the Black church or the white church or even the diverse church in a lot of ways. And so I think the younger generation, they're looking at that and going, that's me. Like, that's what I feel every day of my life. It's just like this organic, just existence way of being. And I think Maverick did a really good job at that. And as someone who grew up listening to gospel and then also loving CCM worship and CCM music, I'm like, that's the way to do it, I think. If you're going to blend two worlds, don't lose the soul. Still have the soul, you know, but just have like that perfect blend. I feel like they just nailed it without trying to. Is the other thing is they don't try to nail it, you know.
The interesting part to me, and you could push back on this if you want, but I feel like when you have that, the art itself becomes an evangelistic tool versus, in my humble opinion, if we're talking CCM and what's working on radio, it is more or less preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
And it's making Christian music for Christians,
yeah.
which has a time and a place.
For sure.
But moments that can transfer and go beyond just Christian audiences, I think, or Christian consumers even, right? Christian audience, but then it's like a target Christian consumer. Yep. I think impact, like you said, on social media and really do become an evangelistic tool for people. Have you experienced some of that in terms of your music and people checking for it that are like, yeah, I don't really know about this whole Jesus thing, but you're dope?
Oh yeah, 100%. I literally just saw someone say this under one of my Instagram reels. I'm not even Christian, but I can't deny that this is fire. Mm. And I'm like, man, that's why we fight for excellence in the studio, you know, and we don't just go, oh, this is good enough. You know, we're like, no, like, let's fight for this thing. And so seeing that, I'm like, that's why we do it. Last weekend, actually, at our concert, a girl came up to me. Actually, sorry, not the girl. The mom came up to me and she says, can I pull you aside? I was like, yeah, of course. She's like, well, I dragged my daughter here tonight. She's not a believer. And I was like, you have to come. And so she watched my set. And then immediately after my set, she goes up to my merch table to buy my merch because she wanted my merch. And she's like, she's not even Christian. You know, she was like, and so you planted something tonight in her. And I'm like, that's why we do what we do, is for people like that to hear a different sound of Christian music that they feel like they can relate to. And then another girl came up to me. She's like, I dropped all secular music And I was just praying, like, Lord, give me something. And then I heard your song Stayed on Him. She's like, and I listen to your music all the time. And so it's like, sure, the accolades, like the numbers, they are fine. It's exciting, like seeing the progress of the career. But I'm really after the hearts of people like that, you know, that need an alternative to listen to that's good, you know. So, yeah.
That's beautiful. I want to come back to the idea of fighting for excellence in a studio mm-hmm. because I'm a geek and I really want to know how that practically looks, yeah. right? But I think what you just described reminds me of what my buddy Dallas does over at The Chosen, where they are in theaters right now, season 4, episode 1-3, and they are intentionally saying, hey, take your non-Christian friends and family
yes.
to these events,
yep.
and we're going to depict a creative and authentic Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make great, excellent work.
Right.
And it becomes an evangelistic opportunity to bring someone to a movie theater. They may not go to a church. Bring them to Pechanga Casino.
Right.
They may not go to yeah. a church.
Yep.
And I think that is so, so dope. So do you see any of those same parallels between you, what you guys are doing, what you're doing, and other forms of media like The Chosen?
Yes, man. We just watched The Chosen in the theaters the first week it came out. And
you watched this one that just came out? Okay.
I left bawling my eyes out. I was like, man, why y'all do us like this? But yeah, no, I do see that parallel there. And I think they're encouraging more Christians to go and fight for that excellence, you know. And I think Christians have to take up space in the world more mm-hmm. in artistic ways. I think historically that's what the church has always
right.
done. And I think we need to just continue in that legacy. I think we kind of got stalled a little bit, you know, once we figured out what works, you know, we got trapped there. But man, if you want your kids to latch on to something that's about the kingdom of God, it's got to be art.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be art, yeah. you know, yeah. and so that's why I'm passionate about making sure that we're fighting for that.
Yeah. What's unique about what you just said is that I was able to exemplify that last night. Me and my son are doing our devotional, and we're reading about Jesus calling Peter to walk on the water.
Yeah.
And he was like, what do you think that looked like? What do you think that was? And I said, oh, my buddy did it in his TV show. And he's like, really?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so we
yeah.
pulled up the walking on water yeah. scene from the season 3 finale.
Yes.
And we were able to watch it, yep. and he was like, well, and I was like, okay, this part, this is adding narrative. This is extra biblical,
yeah, right,
right?
Right?
But everything here is the what it probably looked like
yep.
and how it looked. And he was just like, whoa. So mm-hmm. so it made the scriptures kind of come illuminate in a different way.
Yep.
And then he was also thinking of the creative, like, how did they pull that off? Like,
yeah,
how
right.
did they do that? And I'm like,
right.
I'll show you a video tomorrow of yep. how they did the technical side of
yep.
it, right? So I think that's so awesome, and I think you nailed it. So tell me, season four, episode three. So they show. I was at the premiere in LA,
mm-hmm.
and they showed us the first two episodes, and it didn't show us episode three.
Oh.
And then Dallas sent it to me.
Okay.
Dallas was like, "Here, like you should watch this almost controversial episode ever." And I was like, "Okay." And I'm like, "Where is this going? Where is
Dude.
This going?" And then they get, and we're not, you know, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it,
yeah.
we're gonna give you some spoilers right here. But what did you think of Rema and Thomas and just that whole thing?
Dude, when it happened, I went, this is how they're setting up the Doubting Thomas narrative.
That's right.
For sure, right?
I thought the same thing.
You know,
yeah,
but I was like, surely he's not going to kill someone with a sword, because I feel like we haven't really been there yet in the show. And the way they set it up, I was like, no way. Is it really Rema? Huh? And I gasped, like I literally sat up and my hands were over my mouth for like 2 minutes. I just could not believe it. And then I started sobbing. Funny thing is, I was sitting next to Jay, who works on The Chosen set. And he also is in Toby's band with me this year. And I'm just sobbing and he's over there sobbing. And then Raimi is sitting next to me and I go, wait a minute. Jay, did you know this was gonna happen? He was like, yeah, I watched it happen every day.
And
I was like, dude.
Yeah.
He was like, I obviously couldn't say anything, but like seeing his reaction, you know, even but it was, the movie theater was just stunned, you know, and I was like mad. I was really mad about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just felt bad for Thomas, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted Thomas to be married so bad. So as a human, I'm
yeah.
watching it and I'm like, man, the Peter and his wife
yeah.
is super cool.
Yep.
I would just read this yesterday in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul writes about the other apostles having wives.
Right.
So
yes.
It wouldn't have been outside of the possibility for all of them to be married potentially, right? Because he talks about them, hey, the apostles travel with their wives and you guys take care of them.
Yep.
And if I'm sowing spiritually, shouldn't I receive material, being taken care of materially? Mm-hmm. So it was so interesting. So I'm like, oh yeah, Thomas is going to have a wife and they're going to go be missionaries. So in church history, they say Thomas went to India.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think there's this like, oh yeah, like this is how they're going to go be do missions work together, which was within the lines. So then when that happened, I'm sitting there thinking, because I texted Dallas and I'm like, I was like two things. One, she's almost the first martyr. In a way?
Yeah, in a way, yeah.
But he's like, no, because it was more of an accident. She didn't die for her faith. And I was like, okay, fair enough. But then the more controversial part, those of us that, flow in more charismatic circles, is Jesus seeing someone and not healing them.
Thomas's face when he looks up, and I felt it for him. I was like, surely, right? He could.
Right.
He's right there.
Right.
And then that just struck another place.
Yeah.
Like, and when we talked about that part afterwards, that's when my buddy Brian started crying, because it's like, if you believe that God is with us, he's here. He could heal at any moment if he wanted to.
Yep.
And then he doesn't, and just having to wrestle with that through the lens of Thomas was really tough. But ultimately it's you either trust God or you don't trust God, and I think that's the tension there,
I think it's so relatable because so many folks have gone through loss. When I was 19, my best friend died of pneumonia, and we prayed and believed and had the anointing oil and had the elders come and lay hands. And even when I got the call that it had taken a turn, I was like, oh, surely he's not going to die.
Right.
Surely he's not going to die. He's only 20 years old.
Yep.
And then he dies. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to go that way.
Right.
And you don't have those answers, right? Anyone that goes through suffering, you don't have those answers while you're going through it. And we may not ever have those answers. We don't know until we get to heaven why certain things happen. So I think they're speaking to the most relatable human emotion, which is suffering,
of course,
and death.
Yep.
Right.
Which is a part of life. And I think something that that always strikes me to read is scripture saying to have joy in suffering.
Mm.
And if it's encouraging us to have joy in suffering, that means it's absolutely possible to have joy and suffering, but also a way that we get to share in the life of Christ is through suffering as well. And as someone who grew up charismatic, I saw healing happen like instantly. Mm-hmm. That was a normal part of our like church experience, so when it doesn't happen instantly, that's what's rocked my world a little bit. But I think lately I've found more joy in suffering and being perfectly fine with it, and just accepting that this is a way I get to learn about Christ more and relate to him more in a deeper level is pain. And I think that can be beautiful if we allow it to be beautiful, and so welcoming it,
That's good. Tell me about how you grew up. You said you grew up charismatic, seeing healing. Folks that may not know a whole lot about your story, I believe you got into music and signed at a relatively young age, but what was life like before that?
So I grew up singing in my granddad's church. I started singing at like 5 years old.
And this is in Memphis?
In Memphis, okay. Yep. North Memphis, actually. They would just randomly call people up to sing songs, and I was five, and they asked me to come sing a song. And
Were you good?
No, 5 years old.
Is there any video?
I think there's like a old tape of it somewhere, but like I remixed the ABC song.
Okay.
But they heard like a little bit of like tone in my voice, and they were like, oh, she might have something, So my Aunt Carolyn would always have me up to sing every Sunday. And that's when I started getting better at singing. And then, of course, my mom, she's freaking out that I can sing. So she was telling all of my teachers that I could sing. And so I was just in choir, like, from literally elementary on up to 12th grade. I grew up singing in the church, singing at revivals all the time. And feeling like the presence of God, like knowing that was a real thing. And I think if there were ever a point of like wrestling with my faith, I'd go back to those moments of like, I know that God is real. Like I've seen him, I've felt him, you know, and not like forced stuff either. Like not trying to feel him.
Yeah, not trying to sauce up the keys on the piano and create the vibe.
Like,
but just
undeniable, you know, like, man, I don't feel like being here. I got school tomorrow, you know, then feeling the presence of God, you know? So, I grew up in that. Yeah.
So how does that gift then transition into a career? How does that 5-year-old who's on stage singing her version of the ABCs with a little bit of tone then grow to all of this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I became very ambitious, so I was just always auditioning for a bunch of stuff. So like X Factor, The Voice, American Idol, local community plays. Just I wanted to be a part of all the things.
How old are you at this point?
I was probably a teenager around this time, so 15, 16. Okay. And so I think the first show I auditioned for, was X Factor. And then I made it in front of the judges. And I got like 3 yeses, 1 no. Simon Cowell did not like me.
Oh.
Yeah, which I was like, okay, fine. That's okay.
Yeah, he has some interesting taste in general, though.
Yeah, yeah. I was 14. He goes, you know, that was very juvenile. And I was like, well, I mean, I am 14, you know, but okay, whatever. and so I was supposed to make it to like the next like Hollywood round.
Sure.
But then I got a call from the producer. Sorry, your name didn't make the list for boot camp. So that rocked my world.
Did they say why?
No, they didn't say why. You know what? I think the excuse actually was we have too many people or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's
an, I was like,
it's
he just didn't like me because Simon didn't like me, you know?
And you're 14, 15 at this point?
I was 14 at that time.
14.
14, yeah.
So you're auditioning for one of the biggest shows in the world.
Uh-huh.
And Simon tells you no and calls you juvenile. Is there footage of this or no?
I don't know that there's footage of that. Okay. The only shot I saw of me was like standing side stage during someone else's audition.
Okay.
Because this was in front of like a live audience. Yeah. So it was so funny. And then I was like, well, I'm just going to keep going. And so then I auditioned for American Idol. Didn't make that because the lady who was running like the local auditions for that wanted me to be a part of her musical that she was doing in Memphis. Yeah, so I ended up in Camp Rock the musical, and that was so much fun. Like one of like the best experiences of my life. Being around a bunch of theater kids was so awesome. And then I auditioned for The Voice, got flown out to LA for that. Didn't make that, but a producer from there reached out to me because he was now working for American Idol. And then I made it to like top 48 with American Idol.
Okay.
And I was around 19 maybe when that happened, 18 or 19.
So you said ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing a book on godly ambition.
Yeah.
Because I think it's so important. And I think there's a war on ambition right now for people who are creative, for people who are industrious, for people that just want to make the most with their time, talent, and treasure on this side of eternity. But there's also a darkness to ambition.
Yeah.
And sometimes that darkness, you use that as fuel.
Yeah.
So in your journey, as you're getting these no's from the biggest shows, the most linear shows, right, in terms of having as much of a top of funnel, massive platform as quickly as possible, those would be the routes, right? Because I'm assuming this is before the days of TikTok and before the days of virality. So in that process, was there did you end up using some of that rejection and that shame and that juvenile and those no's as fuel to like, I'm about to show y'all,
dude? I wish I could say I did. I did not. Like,
okay.
American Idol's no crushed me for about 2 months.
Uh-huh.
I was really questioning what was next in life, which is funny to think about. I was like 19. I'm like, girl, you got your whole life ahead of you. Like, stop it. But man, just it crushed me. And I think that's when the Lord allowed me, just like softened my heart to just live with open hands now. And I had a moment where I was just like, Lord, whatever your will is for my life, that's what I want.
Did you go on there as a Christian artist? I'm unapologetic for Jesus. Or were you kind of going on there as a, I'm going to be a mainstream artist who's a Christian? And there's no judgment on either one.
No, for sure.
But in hindsight, at the time, what was your heart back then?
So at the time, I was pretty plugged into church and pretty excited about being a worship artist, actually, at the time. So when he reached out to me, I was like, hey, I'm not really into pop music anymore. I'm not going to sing anything like negative. So I don't know where you guys are right now with the show, with all of that. But I'm like trying to be extremely intentional about what it is I'm singing. So I was wanting to do worship music at the time.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
But he was like, you don't have to sing anything you don't want to sing, you know. But,
okay.
Yeah.
And so what did that opportunity then evolve into?
That, I think that led me to that posture of heart with the Lord of let your will be done in my life. And my manager and I, Jill, both decided, you know, it's best to just live with open hands. Mm. And so whatever door he opens, that's the door we want. Whatever door he shuts, we don't want to walk through that. We're good, you know. And then my manager, I remember we were in a hotel and she looks at me and she goes, we need to get you on Toby Mac's team.
Mm.
And I was like, okay. I didn't really know Toby well because I was mostly familiar with gospel music at the time. And just now starting to figure out who Hillsong was. So Toby wasn't on my radar. And I was like, sure, you know, if you're, like, why not, you know? And she had remembered just working with his team when they came to our church, like, years ago, like, observing his merch team. And felt like it was a reflection of leadership, you know? And so, yeah, she made the right call. We knew someone who knew his manager, and he connected us to Toby's manager, and Toby's manager brought us out to Nashville, and I wrote a lot that week, you know? But yeah, so...
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. One, you're suffering in that moment,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You're disappointed, and obviously it's not to the degree of some of the other stuff that people have gone through,
yep.
but to you, that's a real pain.
Real moment, yep.
That leads you to a place of just brokenness and just, God, whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
do what you will with this. And then the creative ideas of Jill to say, hey, like, this would be a good fit.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then having the resources and the ability to track down someone.
Yeah.
And get you in the room.
Yep.
Because it's one thing to have the idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing to be connected enough to get you in the room.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's wild. And another crazy thing is 3 years before I was signed, I went to sing at a French church. And there was this guy who had a prophetic gifting there. And after I sang, he came up to me and he goes, in 3 years, you're going to sign a record deal.
Hmm.
And I was like.
Like on the nose. 3 years.
3 years.
Wow.
And so I looked at my dad. I was like, is he a real like prophet? Like, is he telling the truth? Because at the time I was like in the Voice is like process and I wanted to be on the Voice. And yeah. so if I'm going to sign in 3 years, that means I'm not going to make it on the Voice. And
right.
so as a kid, like that's where my like immature, you know, mind was going. And then sure enough, man, 3 years later, I signed that record deal at Goatee,
wow.
which is why. And so I immediately like thought of him and I was like, Dad, do you have Prophet Mike's like info? Because this actually came to pass,
wow.
you know. So,
were you still a teenager? When
I
you
was
signed?
Still a teenager. Well, no, not a teenager when I signed. I was a teenager when that happened. I think I was about 20 or 21.
Okay,
when I signed, yeah.
So I mean, you're still
yeah.
super super duper young yeah. and early in the
yeah.
process. Wow, that's interesting. Got that prophetic word, huh?
Dude, yep. It was wild. I was like, oh, my goodness. Like, I checked the date. I was like, wow, 3 years. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. And it seems like Goatee and Toby have done a really good job with how they've allowed you to express yourself and blossom.
Yes. Yes. Which is so helpful. I think they do a really good job, I think, with whatever artist they sign and helping them just blossom in their sound and the thing that they're passionate about. So, I'm blessed to be on that, you know.
Now, you mentioned Christian hip hop,
mm-hmm.
and you were like, Christian hip hop is a struggling one.
yeah.
Shots fired. Okay. So what is your impression of Christian hip hop, right? Obviously, you were, I'm assuming, yeah, you guys had to have been label mates at some point, you and Aaron Cole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
right?
Yep.
Who I think just, his deal was done there a couple years ago. I don't remember the exact timeline.
Yep.
And you obviously, you're familiar with it. So
mm-hmm.
so what do you make of what Christian hip hop is?
Man, I like it a lot. I do think they're probably struggling with, you know, initially it was all about like preaching the gospel, you know, mm-hmm. in a grungy, like street way, you know, and I think the culture at the time needed that specific thing. And I think when that shifted, you know, because of course you're trying to keep up with what culture is doing, because I think that's the best way to like impact culture. I think maybe the audience started freaking out a little bit, you know, and like, y'all ain't preaching the gospel no more, you know.
Mm.
And so I think that's the struggle, is like they lose all of that support, you know, of that audience. So I'm like, that's rough, you know. But I think younger people are like, I think there's a balance there, you know, where you can make music. If you pay attention to the lyrics, it's obviously Christian. This is coming from someone who walks with the Lord, if you pay attention to it. But, you know, I think people maybe just want them to be street preachers, but like through the vein of music. And I don't think that's who they are necessarily. So I think it's just in a weird, weird space right now, them trying to figure out how to do that, make it work.
I think you're spot on. Yeah. I think you're so spot on, especially going back to, you know, when, I mean, I was around Lecrae and those guys, mm-hmm. Rebel, 2007, seeing them do block parties in Philly while he was still signed to Cross Movement, or he had just gotten off Cross Movement. So I've seen that personally, and I've seen the heavy just theology content.
Yeah.
And then the shift slowly happening. And then the audience being confused because, like, hey, like we thought this was for our youth group kids, and now what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
I think this is my assessment now, and I'd love to hear you push back. I think now the ability to get to the ceiling of Christian rap is so much easier because you can get into the algorithms and you can get pop in within that, but then that cap doesn't really get you to where you want to be, which is a lot of these guys want to be mainstream artists.
Yeah.
Right? So you can get popping, like you can, mm-hmm. boom, now I'm here. Oh, sweet. Like I'm going to do youth groups for a couple thousand dollars and I'm making money. And I can, like, you get to that place of like, I can sustain myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier there.
Yeah.
But the lid, you get comfortable too easy is basically what I'm getting
100%.
At.
100%. I think, man, I don't think it's fair though to know that that's where you want to go, mm-hmm. is to mainstream and then use.
Oh, I don't think it's fair,
you know,
at all.
I know you're not saying but I think generally speaking, if you want to be mainstream,
go be mainstream.
Mm-hmm. You know, like don't like use this platform to jump. Mm-hmm. That's not fair. Then that's when you are going to get that pushback, you know?
Yep.
And I think rightfully so.
Yep.
You know, like if people are trusting you into their homes, like with their kids and their churches and all of that, then be about that space, you know, do ministry there. But if you're called to go do mainstream, go do that.
Well,
you know?
the my buddies who have believed they were called had to make intentional pivots away, mm-hmm. from Christian music. So I'll give you two examples. One example is a Rapzilla freshman named Nick D.
Okay.
And Nick was a Rapzilla freshman. He was in that ecosystem. And then he made a hard pivot and, mm-hmm. went all in on making pop music on TikTok.
Right.
And now Nick is at like four or five million monthly listeners,
mm-hmm.
completely independent.
Yep.
I'm talking like Nick doesn't have an agent. He doesn't have a manager. He doesn't have a publicist. He does not leave his farm in Virginia, mm-hmm. for anything.
Yep.
And he does not play churches. Mm-hmm. He does not do youth groups. He does not, outside of me and maybe a handful of other people, doesn't collaborate with any Christian artists. So he like went hard, and his music's still clean.
Yeah.
But it's not. He intentionally pulled away from the community that engaged him. Same thing happened with Toby,
mm-hmm.
Different Toby, Toby Nwigwe. And then, have you been keeping up with Paul Russell at all?
The Boothang guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So Paul's a Christian.
Oh, yes.
So we did our first two albums with Paul. I put out his first two albums, and it was the same thing. It was like, hey, I got these shows popping, and I'm, mm-hmm. doing these things.
Yep.
But around the pandemic, he was already in L.A. He moved to LA, but he made an intentional decision to like, I'm going all in on TikTok.
Yeah.
I'm not doing any more Christian. I did like a couple of Reach Records things, mm-hmm. but I'm not really doing any more Christian things like that unless I'm like really friends with someone. And then over time, after hacking and hacking and hacking and, mm-hmm. hacking and hacking and hacking TikTok for like a year and a half, 2 years, he finally got, he had a couple other moments, but he finally got Boothang. And then it was just, popping off.
Oh,
and then he signed with Arista, and they were able to. So two totally different routes, right? Yep. Like Nick went to completely independent. I don't have a team. There's no one that's full time that works for him, which is crazy.
Wow.
I have 3 full time employees. No one works for him. I'm like, who works for him? He's like, no one. And I'm like,
wow, man.
And then Paul, who's in the major label, mm-hmm. system, but to your point, both of which had to have made a pivot. Now, here's what I think in Christian music, again, you can get popping faster.
Yeah.
But then you get entitled and comfortable. And you don't really understand the work that goes into what you're doing.
Yes.
Having to go be on the road for 30 days.
Yep.
And post consistent TikTok and, mm-hmm. Instagram reels.
Oh, yeah.
And post YouTube video. I'm watching what you guys are doing, and I'm like, you guys are active.
It is a full-time
It's a full-time, gig. It's multiple full-time things, right? And I see the Christian rappers, and I'm just, y'all just don't want it.
Man.
Y'all don't want it. Y'all don't want to do 100 songs for in 130 weeks with content for every song and making them better each. Y'all don't really want, and I'm saying that's what it takes to get popped into mainstream and to get into those
that's
egos.
That's so true.
And I was like, y'all don't really want to do it.
I think the other thing is if our audience, our Christian audience, just wants like the alternative sound, right? You could just keep feeding that easily.
Right.
You know what I mean? But mainstream is just tough.
Yeah.
It's tough to like crack through that thing, you know? Yeah. And I think that speaks to like the 100 songs. Do you have, I think you have to write a crap ton of songs so that one could make it to mainstream, you know? Yeah. But if Christians are easily receptive to anything that sounds different, that's pretty easy to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, you got to write 100 songs to get the 98 bad ones out. Of you, and then you find the two bona fide hits that cross over.
Right.
And that is, that's hard.
That's really tough.
It's hard.
Yeah.
So anyway, coming back to this idea of fighting for excellence in the studio. Okay, so now I want to know, because as a rapper, our process is different.
Right.
Our process is different. Mm-hmm. As a Christian, and probably to the detriment of what we just talked about.
Yeah.
It's easier to make the songs. It's easier to mix the songs. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your process and what is it really like being in the studio? Is how often are you keeping the first couple of takes? How often you got to go retract the vocals? How often are you writing something that you thought was good and then you listen to it and you're like, I got to rewrite this whole thing or I'm going to keep four bars, right? Tell me about that process and like, what does that mean to fight for excellence? And specifically, like, I want to nerd out about your process in the studio.
Right. Man, I am borderline perfectionist in the studio. I will recut some vocals like nobody's business and have my producer scratching his head. I'm like, I don't hear what you're hearing. And I'm like, I hear it. I didn't have the right breath support on that note, you know? So a lot of it is like vocally for me. Then also, man, if a chorus isn't landing well, like I'm like, we gotta start over. Or I will spend 3 hours writing one thing and then I'm like, nope, we're changing the whole thing. Like it, I've done that several times, you know, because I'm just like, dude, it's not right. And time is valuable. So if it's, I'm not going to spend another 3 hours if it's not working, you know.
Now, are you ever recording yourself or are you always with the engineer in a professional room?
I record with myself when I'm like doing a cover of another song or just like messing around in GarageBand for fun, you know.
But not, but none of that is ever, is that ever making into anything?
No.
So there's never like, oh, I like this vibe and I, like that, the emotional state I was at when I
I'll send it to him. Here's the vibe, kind of like what I was thinking.
But you're going in and recutting it.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Yeah, because it's like you need the right mic, you know, and the right plugins and all of that. But yeah, man, I will sit there and I'll just watch a producer work and like, oh, that sound, you know, this thing, you know, I just like to be a part of the whole process, you know. I feel like I'm not doing my job as an artist if I'm not there. And I know it's easy to be able to like to just leave and check out, you know, but I can't do it, you know.
So if you go to the studio today, it's 1 o'clock right now. What are the odds you can leave the studio today with a completely finished song?
Absolutely not.
No odds.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No. Nope.
How many days of, if you were just to focus on one song, the objective for this week is to get one song completely done on your part. Then someone else is going to mix and master it. How many consecutive days do you think that would take? Because obviously you're jumping around, you're working on other stuff, but for the sake of this thought experiment.
Because things change so often, I would give myself 3 weeks max. Which
3 weeks?
Yeah.
Holy moly. Okay.
But I think that's even short for like Toby. That man's working on a song for like 3 or 4 months.
Wow.
Like he's like going like verse and line by line sometimes, you know, like he's just like that. So if he hears 3 weeks, he's like, man, 3 weeks, that's all you like, my goodness, you know, but 3 weeks. Yeah. Like, especially for the album, I was like, no, we need to redo that. Not feeling that. I need to come back in. Hey, man, I know I said I wasn't going to come in today, but can I please come in today?
Are you doing this in Memphis or are you in Nashville all the
Nashville.
Time? You're at the Nashville.
Yeah, my husband and I moved to Nashville.
So you guys are basically, now you live in Nashville.
Yeah, now,
Okay.
Before then, though, it was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, because that's like a three-hour drive?
Yeah, three-hour drive.
Yeah, that's not an easy commute.
Yeah.
Whew. Okay, so 3 weeks, the fastest you're going to get a song done.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then also you got to think, too, like when you're writing for the album, man, my song Matthew 5, I wrote that in 2021, like demo. So it's just been sitting there until production. And, you know, I've just had all these ideas just like real, like spinning around in my head for it. And then you finally get to production, you know, and it's like you do what you can that day, but then you got to go back. You know, it's just a, it's a process. It takes forever.
Do you think there's anything to the model of quantity, or did you ever go through that model of, like, again, Nick did 83 songs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Almost every week.
Wow. I don't do that.
And then the 83rd one was Fine Apple.
Yeah.
Fine Apple got him to deal with Universal Republic. He did a one song deal with Universal Republic. He couldn't put out music for 90 days.
Wow.
So then he stacked up music for 90 days and it went right back to releasing a song a week. And so granted, he's not doing three part harmonies and
of
a lot
course.
Of the stuff you're doing, but he is singing. He is singing on this stuff. And he's, you know, his tone is decent. He's used Waves Tune to correct it.
Yeah.
I don't even think he uses Melodyne like that.
Wow.
Do you think there's anything to that? Or can that model even work with this genre of music, right? Because we're not talking pop music. Like what you're doing is a hybrid. Like you are the niche again.
Yeah.
So what do you make of that model?
Oh man, I think for me it's capacity because I have a full time job as well. It's like being a solo artist, you know. So I'm like, any pockets that I have when I'm home, I'm in the studio.
Okay.
Like I'm writing as much as I can, and because it's not going to be 83 songs, you know, it might be like 25 really good ones because of the amount of time I get to like spend on it, you know. And then we go, okay, out of these 25, what are the really, really good ones, you know? So
and those 25 again, complete, like full vocals, everything done.
As far as demos go.
Oh, so not even 25 mixed songs.
No, no. So we go from, okay, boom, demos. Okay, here are like about 15 that we want to like go and like start production on and see what happens.
Whoa.
And then you chop down a couple more. And then if there are ones where like, there was one song on the album where we were like, man, we don't know about this one. But I just fought hard for it. Mm. And I just like, maybe we need real drums, you know, and that, you know, so yeah. Yeah.
Respect. Yeah. That's incredible. Okay. So we talk a lot about like the business side on my third channel of the creative entrepreneurial journey, right? Which I think ultimately that's what we all are, is we're creatives, but we're also entrepreneurial. You just mentioned something. You said you still work a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would look and say 1.5 million monthly listeners, hundreds of thousands of subscribers on YouTube, hundreds of thousands of Instagram followers. How do you balance that and how does that work for you in terms of right now you're still working I'm assuming it's not a 9-to-5.
No, it's not a 9-to-5. Okay. So I'm full time with Toby in his band. So
that's a job.
Yeah, that's a job.
And then you're also the artist.
Yeah, right. So I think having that web of like, this is his label and this is, you know, so I think there's just that general understanding of like, I do this and I also do this, and I just have to be extremely intentional on those pockets of time that I have. So when I'm home, I am going to treat it like a Monday through Friday type situation. Like, you know, with touring, 4 days on, 3 days off. I'm like, no 3 days off. Mm. You're going to go to the studio.
Wow.
You know, you're going to go recut that vocal that you need to go cut, you know. And so I have to work like that to make the most of the time that we have.
That's interesting. You know, we were just having this conversation with my nephew. He just started full time with us, and he asked me the question, like, how do you monetize your passion and how do you monetize the thing you want to do?
Yeah.
And I said, well, sometimes you monetize it by working in alignment of something that's related to it for a season, and then you eventually monetize it as the main thing, right? And so I said, like, if someone's passionate about being a YouTuber, sometimes you go work for and with another YouTuber for a season.
Yep.
And at least you're doing the thing you love and you don't got to work, you know, at a Hertz rental car.
Right.
Right. Like you actually have something in the area and you're developing. You're getting paid to learn. You're developing skills.
Right.
You're getting the time under tension. And so it's kind of like your journey.
That's exactly it. You know, I mean, I was blown away by just like the Lord's kindness and all of that. You know, I didn't even know to ask to be in Toby Mac's band. That wasn't even a thought. I was just trying to, you know, sign to the label. And so you step into this world, this like well-established machine that's been going on for 30 years, you know. And I'm like, I'm going to use this opportunity to just learn, to ask questions, to learn how to be a leader, learning the importance of character and integrity, and how do you relate to both band and crew, and the passion behind like making sure those two worlds work together well, and it's not these separate things, you know, like some weird like hierarchy, you know. And so I've just been learning, and watching how to put a show together, how to like function in the studio, how to speak to your manager, like all of the things, you know. And I just feel like I've just had this like masterclass. And like you're saying, you're being paid to do it, you know. So it's been like really, really special. And I'm always just like, Lord, you're so kind for allowing me to do this. And now my husband stage manages for Toby, and so he's, you know, so we get to travel together,
that's
so amazing, you know. So we're just always blown away by what we get to do.
That's incredible. Would you recommend the path that you've gone on in terms of doing what you're doing, right? Like, hey, it's good to go learn underneath someone for a season.
Yep.
Because the reality, the flip side to all this is a lot of these folks who are blowing up have never done a show.
I know.
So man, their first time, I think, who was it? I want to say Ice Spice's first show was in a 2,500 cap theater.
Oh my goodness.
And she got roasted for it.
Poor girl.
Because she had never performed.
Holy smokes.
So you know, you're coming, you're doing walkthroughs, you know, that world, you're doing walkthroughs in clubs.
Of course.
And then you pop up and your first show is in a 2,500 theater.
My goodness.
And you're just thrown to the wolves, and you just get to figure it out.
Oh, dude, that's rough.
That's crazy.
That's like really crazy.
But that's the opposite of what you're describing.
Yes.
The opposite of what you're describing is instead of going and learning and sitting and developing, artist development, you mentioned that earlier, you go mega viral, which is, I'm sure has to feel great for the ego, and you're making money and all these things, that like all that's probably cool. But then your first show might be in front of a bigger audience than you could handle, really.
I know, man. I think if you take the same principle in scripture where it says, like, you know, a new believer probably shouldn't be teaching.
That's right. That's right. That's good.
I think we need to bring more of that over into the artist realm.
Come on.
Because when people blow up so fast, man, if that character is not intact,
well,
it's a recipe for a disaster.
But you know, the tricky part about that in the Christian world is the soft ticket shows.
Yeah.
Because now there's a whole world where you're doing events, soft tickets. And I don't think the human brain, like I remember performing at the Rock Church, Miles McPherson, one of the biggest churches out here in San Diego, for their Easter service, like 2008, 2009. This is early. And my brain, I don't think our brains have the capacity to decipher on if there's 3,500 people in the room,
right?
15,000 people through the Sunday.
Yeah.
I don't think our brain has the capacity to say, oh, they're not really here for me. They're here for Easter.
Yeah.
I think you're just like, I'm in front of 3,500 people.
Yeah, like, this
people,
is crazy.
And this is crazy.
Yeah, right.
And so I think in the Christian world, I think that's, and I honestly think that's some of the detriment within a Christian rap scene.
Yeah.
Is a lot of these guys got to these festivals and got to these, I mean, I remember watching Lecrae do arenas in 2010, 2011.
Yeah.
The Rock and Roll Worship Tour, and there's 15,000 people.
Yeah, a lot of people there.
And it's like, but they're not there necessarily for you because you do that same market and you have to sell tickets,
right?
And all of a sudden it's a different room. But at least it gives you a more accurate gauge of who's there and who's not there.
Right.
So what do you make of that in terms of the do you think that the Christian world kind of enables that sometimes in terms of like platforming people a little too early?
Of course.
And they don't know that, like, they're not really here for me.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we see artistry differently than we see, like, full-on ministry within a church. Mm. You know, those are two completely different things, but I think that same principle of, like, hey, being discipled and being trained under someone who is far more seasoned than you are is very important, you know, and I was blessed to have that, you know. But I also think making sure your team around you are grounded in the word as well, and like grounded in prayer and the Holy Spirit, you know, so when you are tripping, they can just pull you aside. Man, that ain't it, you know. And so I would say my team, like my manager, my husband, like friends that I have, they're honest people, you know. So if you at least don't have that, man, you're gonna struggle.
It sounds like from everything I've heard about the circle you're in terms of Goatee and knowing some of the folks there, it sounds like for the most part, from everything I've heard, love Jesus, solid people, really about the walk.
Yep.
But we all know that not everyone in the Christian world
rolls
that way. Mm-hmm. That there are people in this ecosystem that like, I couldn't make it mainstream, so I just went a bit of Christian.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you start bumping into people backstage and you start having conversations and you're like, wait, I don't even know if... Like, y'all don't even go to church.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing, right?
Yep.
Y'all got, have you crossed paths with any of that without being too specific behind the scenes of, hey, like, some of these folks is tripping?
You know, when I have, it's all the same thing. It's insecurity. And I think, you know, artists are probably more prone to insecurity. I think art is vulnerable. I think what stepping on stage and then you got to look at merch numbers every night, you know, and people are unfortunately comparing themselves to just like other artists out there. And so I think insecurity is the root of all of that. And I think you have to be honest about your insecurity and recognize that that's not God's best for you. You have to recognize that. You have to be willing to recognize that. If you become energized from insecurity and the way you just function backstage, man, it's just over time, it's not healthy for you and it's not going to be good for the culture of the tour. And so my encouragement is just check your insecurity, be honest about it. Because I think there is a far more peaceful life on the other side of that.
Amen. I totally agree with you. My question to you would be though, to follow up is what I discovered in terms of doing Christian content is, you know, the stuff that oftentimes gets our attention is like celebrity pastor does something awful, right? Mm-hmm. But then I met a bunch of megachurch pastors and I discovered that the weirdos are the exception to the rule. Most yeah. people love Jesus. They're yeah. doing their best. They're,
yes.
So would you say in the Christian music industry, it's the same way? Like the folks getting drunk after the show and yeah. fornicating and not going to church, they're the exception to the rule. That isn't the majority of people
100%.
Love Jesus.
Okay. Like I've toured for the past like 8 years of my life. And I'm like, yeah, those are just, that's the exception. You know, most of the people that I have toured with, like love the Lord, love their ministry, and also love the industry that they're in is another big one, you know, because I know like people can CCM and they, you know, feel all kinds of ways about CCM, but people feel called to that genre for sure. And so I've just witnessed that, you know, the positivity surrounding that, you know, I think site Mandisa is like the biggest like advocate for CCM. She loves the people that she gets to minister to. Kane, another group, love the people they get to minister to. I've run into a lot of really good people.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's really, really good to yeah. hear. Okay. Last question. Okay. We talked about it a little bit. What do you make of people who start assuming that in order to become successful in an industry, you have to compromise morally? And then they kind of equate that to the Christian industry. It's like, well, these people are only popping because they made some backdoor deal, or they are an industry plant, or they're this or that, or they're that. What you're saying is a complete opposite. You're saying like most of these folks love Jesus, and most of these folks are really trying to. But there is that skeptic, that skeptical, I would say cynical heart in some consumers that you get to a certain degree of success, and they just think that like you're doing some, like they think, I know somebody at YouTube that like pressed a button on my channel. It's like, no, this is just a decade, right? So what do you make of that in terms of people who pursue musicians like that?
I think they think that they're being righteous, but they're actually sinning. You're bearing false witness. That's what I think. I see it happening all the time. And I'm like, dude, you don't even know this person. You know, and you're like, because people want drama so badly, like they say this thing and then knowing, like they know a bunch of people are going to jump on to that because they want the worst to be the truth. And
what is that inside of humans that just, it's so icky, right?
I don't know what that is. And I'm like, that's not cool, you know, because you can truly like tarnish a reputation with a lie, you know, and you're doing it to a brother and sister in the Lord, you know?
Yeah. I will say that the people that I've came across that are successful, especially Christians, tend to be the most kind, generous, not gatekeepy type of people.
Yeah.
And but the perception before was that is how it is. And usually people who are that way are, to your point, just insecure and immature.
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
I think also to that is the same way you work hard at your job, Christian artists are too.
That's right.
You know, and so when you say it's because they're connected to this evil thing or whatever, you're taking away the hard work and the years and the sacrifices that their families have had to make for them to do this, you know. And so I think as an artist, when you're seeing all of that happening, you're like, that's annoying, you know, because you don't know their day-to-day life, you know, and what it took for them to get there. And so, I mean, I just caution people, be so careful about what it is that you say.
Yeah.
You have to be careful, you know.
That's good. Okay, any final words of encouragement, advice, things that you've learned? Someone's watching this. Maybe they are 14, 15, 16-year-old. They're passionate about music. Mm-hmm. and they're watching you, they're inspired, they want to do what you do or something similar, what words of encouragement or advice would you have for them in terms of whatever you think you want to speak into?
I think I would say two things. It's easy as an artist to become so guarded with your baby that is music, but you have to release it to those around you so that they can give you honest feedback and help you navigate this road that is music. No matter if you just want to be in a band or be a producer, whatever that is, be receptive to people's correction. And then two, man, fight for the art, dude. Like, it's okay if it doesn't sound like anything else that everyone else is doing. Whatever comes naturally to you when you're creating music, it's probably what you should be doing, you know? And I think with time, you're able to perfect that. And then people turn heads. They're like, wow, that's really dope, you know? So don't be discouraged if your stuff doesn't sound like what everybody else is doing. That's probably a really good thing.
So you said first, be okay with sharing it, sometimes publishing it, sometimes sharing it privately, right?
Yep.
And then second, be okay with the developing the patience needed, that it's probably going to take way longer than you think it is.
Yes, absolutely, especially if your thing is unique.
Yeah, that's good. All right, where can they find more of you, check you out? You got the new album out, which is amazing.
So you can find the new album, Give It Time, on all streaming platforms, and you can find me on Instagram under I Am Tarian.
All right, guys, thank you so much. Make sure you're following, make sure you're tapped in, and hopefully go see her on tour.
Yeah, come see us.
All right, we're adding to the Bible that prayer is extremely important in terms of us being transformed from the inside out when we get aligned with God's will. For the Christians watching this channel, I want you guys to implement these spiritual disciplines in your day-to-day life. And the only way I've been able to do this consistently is through writing down my prayers in a prayer journal that does a few things. One, it allows me to reflect and come to God humbly and ask Him to move on my behalf. And two, it allows me to document my prayers, which ultimately helped me remember the very things that I was praying for and see the hand of God tangibly in my life when He answers them. So I would urge you, consider writing down your prayers. It could be in a blank notebook. It could even be on your phone. Or you could check out the one I personally designed and used for my own quiet time and spiritual discipline that I think will be a huge blessing. It's the exact structure and system that I've used for years to pray and be more consistent in my spiritual disciplines. You can pick yours up today by clicking the link in the pinned comment below. All right, I'll see you over there. Peace.